From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
People I spoke to, you were one of them, full disclosure. You know, a lot of people grew up and they didn't want to become their parents. They didn't want to put on a suit and tie and go to an office and be a professional, a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant.
That's author Andrew Friedman. He's been talking with me about the many chefs he interviewed for his new book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. It's a fascinating account of how America's culinary scene completely transformed during the 1970s and 80s. I have to say that I know the story well because, well, I was there for it. And man, how times have changed. How many chefs did you interview for the book and over what period of time?
Well, I haven't broken it down into chefs and other industry figures, you know, owners and critics and whatnot, but I interviewed over 200 people for the book. And most of those were interviewed over a period of about 3 years, but I spent a total of 5 years on the book, so there were certain people who were hard to get to. Wolfgang Puck comes to mind, who eventually I was able to spend the better part of an afternoon with, but I was already sitting with an almost completed draft by the time I was able to make that happen. So a couple of stragglers in the last 18 months, but most of those people over a three-year period.
What influence did the political climate of the time have on chefs and how they approached food?
Well, I think, first of all, the political climate of the time, and I guess we're talking the late 60s and into the 70s, I think the biggest influence it had in this country was I think it was one of the things that produced chefs or people who wanted to be professional cooks. I think coming up at a time when there was the counterculture, the Vietnam War and the protest movement, the drug use that was going on, the way pop culture was changing. And I think some of those people found their way to music. I think some of those people found their way to making film. And I think some of those people picked up a knife and started shaking pots and pans and wanted to express themselves in the kitchen. So to me, the biggest sea change that the politics of the time produced was this population of young people in this country who wanted to be cooks.
You know, many people are going to point to Alice Waters and Chez Panisse as the torchbearer of this era of American cuisine, but you say that that's not entirely accurate. Who came before Alice?
A few people. There was a gentleman named Bruce Lefevre, who some people, and this is even going way back, may remember a restaurant called Rose et Lefevre in the Napa Valley. But he had his first restaurant called The Paragon, which was very much influenced by his travels in Europe and his eating of Nouvelle Cuisine before it was even called Nouvelle Cuisine. And he opened his first restaurant here as a chef in 1965. He's all but forgotten, but that's the case. And there were other people who were very much contemporaries of Chez Panisse. There was a gentleman named John Novy, who opened just prior to Chez Panisse in upstate New York, the Dupuis Canal House. Again, he was very much influenced by his travels in Europe, most especially in Italy. Chez Panisse, I think, well, first of all, the virtue of the fact that it was so influential and that so many immensely talented people started there and influenced that restaurant, but I think also by the virtue of the fact that it's still thriving, dominates in history, I think, in a way that maybe suggests to a lot of people that there just wasn't anything else going on. And the only point I try to make in the book is that I don't believe that's true. I think there were other things going on. They were going on pre-internet and pre-Google. So sadly, I think a lot of those people and places have been forgotten. But there were other restaurants and there were other Americans finding their way into kitchens.
We recently lost one of the biggest visionaries of this generation, Paul Bocuse.
Yeah.
He appeared on the cover of Newsweek in 1975 and was the godfather to many of these chefs that we're going to be speaking about. Could you talk about what he did to rechart the culinary landscape?
First of all, there is this misconception that even in France, the role of a chef was sort of lauded always. And that's not true. I tell the story in the book of a gentleman named Alain Sayac, who's currently one of the deans at the International Culinary Center in New York and formerly was the chef of Le Cirque. And when Sayac in the mid-20th century turned to his dad one day and said, I want to be a cook, his father thought he was nuts. His father wanted him to take over the family glove manufacturing business and walked him into town to the kitchen of the one chef that he knew who was an old war buddy of his and said, you know, my son wants to be like you, a stupid chef. And what Bocuse and the chefs who were associated with the Nouvelle Cuisine movement did was two things. One, they took cooking and made it into a more expressive, personal thing. They weren't just cooking from what I call the Escoffier playbook of sort of classic French cuisine. You know, there was a time when you went to French restaurants and the menus were all but interchangeable. Bocuse and his contemporaries broke away from that. But what Bocuse also did, and he wasn't the only one, but he was sort of the ringleader, was came out of the kitchen, came into the dining room, and then around the world. I mean, he was a real ambassador for French cuisine. He was a real marketer, although I don't think he or anyone maybe would have used that word at the time. He did dinners all over the world. He came to the United States at a time when no other French chefs were coming here and doing dinners all over the country. I mean, in places like Texas, and really kind of making the role of a chef into what it's become, into something celebrated, into something that one could become a celebrity doing, into something that one could make money doing. And this dovetailed with these Americans that we were talking about at the beginning of this interview, kind of looking for something else to do. A lot of them were grabbing backpacks and going to Europe. Jonathan Waxman, who's still very prominent, tells this story of going to cooking school in Paris and seeing Paris Match magazine and seeing four French chefs on the cover of the magazine. Bocuse was one of them. This was actually within a year of that Newsweek cover in the United States. And Jonathan was struck by that and thought, hey, that looks cool, you know, to be a chef and maybe being a chef you could get on the cover of a magazine.
And in fact, he did sort of end up on that kind of iconic photo.
You mean the photo on the cover of the book?
Yeah.
It's a photograph that's been around. I know it's in at least one of Ruth Reichel's memoirs. I've seen it in articles, but I'm amazed how many people haven't seen it. But it is the promotional photograph for Michael's Santa Monica restaurant, which opened in 1979. And it's Michael McCarty, who was the owner, Ken Frank, who was the opening chef, Jonathan Waxman, who was an opening sous chef and became the chef pretty shortly after opening when Ken Frank left, and Mark Peel, who was in the kitchen there. Many people say it looks like a band. It looks like an album cover. I just think it's such an evocative image of everything about that time.
So during this time, Alice and Jeremiah Tower were taking over the Bay Area. But we down here in Southern California, we had Wolfgang Puck and the chefs from Michael's.
Yeah.
Speak to the players in Los Angeles and what they were doing differently than their Northern California counterparts.
I always think about Steven Spielberg and how it took so long for him to be recognized by the Academy Awards. And I always felt like there was something similar about Los Angeles and the food movement there that, you know, Wolfgang got so famous that you can't have that and also have sort of the respect I always felt like the city deserved historically. But to me, what was going on in Los Angeles around this time were a lot of food being treated as a very creative, artistic, almost expressive medium. You know, another piece that I think it really had over anywhere else in the country in the late 70s was the way restaurants started to look. You know, they started to look like they belonged in Los Angeles, that they were of Los Angeles, you know, blonde wood and a lot of windows and light coming in and open, where restaurants used to be very kind of dark places.
No carpeting.
No carpeting. Or a place, you know, like the West Beach Cafe, where Bruce Marder, who's still operating very successfully in Los Angeles, artwork by local Venice artists on the walls and basically a cinder block interior and, you know, just a really sort of artistic bent to the whole thing that I think had an energy and an excitement that was uniquely LA.
You talk about how restaurants looked at the time, and I'm thinking about the people who weren't chefs, but who were equally embedded in the scene and how they had such an influence, like Wolfgang's partner, Barbara Lazaroff.
Yeah.
And then the writers and editors and critics like Ruth Reichel.
I don't really know Ruth that well. I just had lunch with her in December. The comment I made to her was that I've always been sort of privately jealous of her and of Coleman Andrews, who was the editor at New West Magazine back in the day. And then he was at the LA Times and created Savoir Magazine. And my feeling had always been that back then, there wasn't the sort of wall that exists to a large extent now between writers like myself and chefs, that it reminded me of sports writers I know who back in the day used to go, down to spring training for baseball season and stay in the same motel as the baseball players and sort of be at the pool drinking beer with them at the end of the day and getting their stories that way. And, you know, Ruth said to me that it was very much like that. And Coleman Andrews has said the same thing to me, that there was this very small, intimate group of people who were pioneering this American food, American restaurant, American chef culture together, that there was this food thing afoot and that they were all part of it. And they were all doing their part to sort of spread it around. And there weren't, the way there are now, publicists and managers and agents and all these people who sort of could get between those two populations, but that they were very united. And then Barbara, who is Wolfgang's ex-wife, as a lot of people probably know, and also his partner who created the look of Spago and of Chinois and other restaurants, you know, her sense of where things were going and her sense of what a restaurant could be. I mean, these things, again, that we take for granted, what she referred to as the exhibition kitchen, the open kitchen at Spago, which she thought of as a stage. I mean, there's this great moment in the book where they're about to open the restaurant and she's standing up on a counter still adjusting the track lighting, almost the way someone in a theater would be adjusting a spotlight. And she says, I thought of these, the cooks were my stars.
Coming back to now, when chef whites are such a positive signifier that even home cooks wear them, and chefs not only can proudly strut down the street in their whites, but find success with product lines, television gigs, multiple cookbooks. This whole celebrity chef wave, is it here to stay?
I think it's very much here to stay. In some ways, I think it's almost become a necessity. I think there are so many people now in the industry. The way that chefs and restaurants distinguish themselves, or one of the ways, and stay competitive is to be in the news or be on television or have a super successful blog or whatever it is. But to stay in the public eye, I think, almost demands celebrity.
That's writer and journalist Andrew Friedman. His book is Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, How Food Lovers, Free Spirits, Misfits, and Wanderers Created a New American Profession. Tonight at 7, Andrew will be talking more about his book at the now-serving L.A. Cookbook Store in Chinatown. It's a free event moderated by former L.A. Times food editor Russ Parsons. You can RSVP by emailing hello@nowservingla.com. After the break, we're talking all about a dessert that's near and dear to my heart. Not so hard to guess. Pie. That's when good food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman.
Hi.
I have to tell you, because of you, I did my first crumb coat.
I'm incredibly proud. Oh, my God.
That is food writer and pastry chef Stella Parks. With KCRW's pie contest just weeks away, we've invited the country's best bakers to dish on their favorite recipes as well as the tricks they have up their sleeve. Stella's the author of the wonderful book on iconic American desserts called Brave Tart. This is the first year for our pie contest that we've actually broken out apple pie as its own separate category. Usually it's just part of the general fruit category, but we discovered that the fruit category was just riddled with apple pies.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't wait this year to see what kind of variety is there. Could you talk a little bit about how simple apple pie actually is, and talk about how recipes seem to get more complicated as the years go by?
Well, one of the most important things is to realize that every recipe does play by its own rules. So there aren't a lot of good, like, universal tips when it comes to something like apple pie. My good friend Kenji, who his apple pie recipe is also on Serious Eats, he treats the apples in a sous vide bath, and I just let mine macerate at room temperature. We treat our apples very differently. It depends on what kind of baker or cook you are and what you've got on hand and what kind of timetable you're working on. So whatever type of recipe you're looking at, obey that recipe and don't think, oh, I read this tip over here that, you know, a really good way to do the apples is with X or Y, and try and apply that, because, you know, they're all playing by their own rules and they're all, you know, taking advantage of certain, you know, features of the apples. If you've got something like a recipe that calls for tapioca starch, which is my recipe does, versus one that calls for cornstarch, those things can't be used interchangeably. And I think people tend to think, oh, it's just a starch. It doesn't matter which one it is. But tapioca is a root-based starch, whereas cornstarch is a grain-based starch, and that gives them very fundamentally different properties. So, you know, you can have, like, really terrible results if you just, you know, willy-nilly switch between the two.
Why do you choose to use tapioca flour?
I love tapioca because it has a very low gelatinization point, which means that you don't have to cook the apples as long or as hard, or any fruit for that matter. I use it for my cherry pie, my blueberry pie, you know, anything like that. I really enjoy the lower cooking point that it has. The other thing that's really helpful with that is because it has such a low gelatinization point, when it's in a recipe that has a reasonable amount of sugar, those two factors kind of come together to give the cooking temperature of the pie, keeping that in a really low range. Whereas if you had something like cornstarch, which has a very high cooking temperature, and you combine that with sugar, sugar elevates the cooking point of most any starch. So when you combine that with sugar, the cornstarch's cooking point actually is above the boiling point. So it can take a long time to really thicken that pie. And you have to boil it really hard and cook the fruit really hard to get it to thicken properly. Cornstarch is great in low sugar to no sugar recipes if you've got like a really naturally sweet fruit that you're not adding much sugar to. But tapioca starch or tapioca flour, it's the same thing either way. It's just sold in under different labels. It also gels completely transparent. So it gives you this really clear, sparkling, kind of crystal clear gel that is just so beautiful, like jewel tone with different fruits.
Okay. This is why I love this job so much. So let me ask you about macerating the fruit. So macerating is just the word used for fruit marination. So do you macerate it with the sugar to allow the liquid to come out so you get less of a problem with gap when you put that top crust on?
Yeah. So the sugar helps draw the liquids out of the fruit, and that's what maceration is, and that's what sets it apart from marination, because you can marinate with anything, but if sugar's involved, then that it becomes maceration and it's pulling the moisture out of the fruit, and that helps it kind of wilt a little bit and helps the apples like decrease in volume, and so you don't have as dramatic a gap when they bake because they're already wilted down somewhat thanks to the sugar. So when they go into the oven, they don't, you know, lose as much volume. Although I think a little volume loss is actually a good thing. People tend to get very stressed out if there's a gap in their apple pie. Historically, that was a very normal and expected part of a recipe. But it keeps the top crust crisp because it's not in, like, complete contact with the wet fruit.
So speaking of the crust, who took sort of the French version of dough and tart crust and Americanized it?
You know, I think that it just kind of evolved in its own way. That's the interesting thing about American baking traditions, is that it evolved in the home, private kitchens, and from, you know, the work of housewives and just people and everyday home environments. And so it was just based on the ingredients and techniques that made sense for small-time baking. You know, you're just making one or two pies at a time or something. Whereas in France, pastry evolved more in a professional context. So it's bakers using techniques that make sense for a professional environment or for necessarily mass production when you're looking at a historic factor. But, you know, in a professional bakery of some variety, or a hotel or a restaurant. So, you know, I don't think that necessarily the types of crust we use in America evolved out of a French style of recipe. I think that they just kind of evolved in parallel on their own.
So let's turn our thoughts now to filling. The no-bake options like key lime or icebox vanilla. Talk a little bit about these fillings and how they're so uniquely American.
Yeah, I think it's just really a curious thing. A lot of these different pies have pretty dramatically different histories. Key lime is one of those interesting things that, you know, where I just said a minute ago, most American desserts evolved from the home kitchen. But key lime actually has a little bit of a commercial background. It's my theory that it evolved out of the test kitchens for the condensed milk companies. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest this is true. A lot of advertisements from companies showing recipes that are just like a key lime pie, just called by a different name. So that's a kind of a high-tech recipe where you're using some of the unique proteins in milk and combining them with the acidity in lime juice or lemon juice and causing like the coagulation of these milk proteins to help thicken the custard. That's pretty wild. And then something like, say, chiffon pie or an icebox pie, a lot of these are based on gelatin. So that's also coming from oftentimes a commercial source, like the Jell-O company or Knox Gelatin promoted a lot of chiffon-type pie recipes in the 1940s and 50s. A lot of these no-bake pies also have a crumb crust. So, you know, you think about something like key lime, graham cracker crust. You think about some of these other types of chiffon pie. They often have like a crushed chocolate wafer crust or a ginger snap crust or something like that. And it's just another cool, like, commercial product that was involved, like, buy these cookies and crush them up and put them with some butter. So definitely a different style of recipe.
I'd love to talk to you briefly about coconut cream pie. It just is such an unusual ingredient. When did it come into favor?
Coconut cream pie is really cool. I mean, it's a recipe that's been in American desserts for a really long time. As soon as we could get coconut into the country, people were making pies by steeping the shredded coconut, which was pretty dry and not in really good shape, and steeping it in milk to rehydrate it. And then once it was like soft and chewy again, then they could, you know, make that into a custard. And then they had this like coconut flavored milk that would also be made into the custard. But eventually, we started getting tins of coconut cream, which was really just what we call coconut milk today. And that was the original cream in coconut cream pie. Coconut has just a really interesting history in how it came into America with the Baker family being big importers of it. And they were actually pioneers in getting coconut to be spelled the way it's spelled today. It used to be spelled with a rogue A smuggled in there. So it looked like cocoa powder, coconut. And that was very confusing to a lot of people. And so the Bakers decided to change the spelling, simplify it, eliminate confusion, help people understand this was not related to chocolate or cocoa in any way, shape, or form. And then they also promoted making coconut cream pie with Baker's coconut milk.
So interesting. I just have to say that your book is something really quite special. The way you seamlessly weave together scientific information, tips, and history throughout the recipes is unique and useful and so enjoyable to work with.
Thank you so much. It was something that I feel like a lot of American desserts are kind of written off as just being a little bit silly or being like, oh, this is just too homey to be taken seriously. And, you know, we give a lot of credence to, you know, French desserts and Italian desserts and Spanish desserts. We think of these as just, you know, really elegant and sophisticated desserts with a rich history. And I just kept thinking to myself that I know American desserts have this kind of background, and I know they work for a reason. So there's an underlying science and there's an underlying history. And I really wish that was something someone had explored a little bit more. And in this case, that person turned out to be me, which is an amazing opportunity.
That's Stella Parks, senior editor at Serious Eats. Her new book, Brave Tart, features all the classics, pie, cakes, cookies, puddings, and then some. She inspired me to actually bake a cake. A cake! Now for an ingredient that you'll be seeing in a lot of pies this time of year. Here's Laura Avery with the Market Report.
I'm here at the market visiting with good friend Robert Wemishner. He is an instructor of professional baking at LA Trade Tech. He comes several times a year with a group of students. However, Robert, you're here solo today. I guess we're on spring break?
Spring break, so I get to explore the market on my own and talk to the farmers on my own and pick out what I want to bring home and make something great with.
So you're here today with your radar on, and what are you finding?
You know, I found some beautiful rhubarb, and I love rhubarb, you know, this ruby red, juicy thing that lends itself to both sweet or savory applications, truthfully, you know, and I'm going to talk about something I love to do, sweet, but not too sweet.
So we have the one farmer, Trevino Farm, on Wednesday, and then Villa Lobos at Saturday. It's funny because all of us from back east, there's just rhubarb all the time, everywhere. But when you say bright red, now I've seen a lot of green, greenish, reddish. It doesn't have to be red, does it?
It doesn't, no. And I you know, a little bit of pink, you know, mm-hmm. which is what it will turn along with the green that you see. So it's just a beautiful spring thing in my mind. And what I do is I make it even more spring-like because, you know, the green teas of Japan, there are seasons. And spring season, we celebrate matcha, which is, of course, the powdered green tea, bright green tea. And I find that matcha and rhubarb really marry beautifully. And what I do is make a quick matcha mousse, basically, so it's dairy-based, and have the rhubarb cooked in a very light sugar syrup. And I pour the juices that come from the rhubarb in the bottom of a beautiful glass, layer in some of the cubed rhubarb, and then a mousse on top of that of the matcha tea, and it's delicious. It's a celebration of spring.
When you cook the rhubarb, when you say you cook it in some syrup, tell us how that process works.
Right. I mean, I cut it up into, you know, like half-inch cubes, and then I put it in a pot, and I add a little bit of water and a sprinkling of sugar, really just a sprinkling, and then watch it carefully, you know, let it come to a light simmer, turn it off, and it's done.
Okay. And then that syrup, then you got that sugar syrup, and that pours off, and then the rhubarb that's left is basically just...
Right.
Just
and I use the syrup in this dessert because I want to see the sort of pinkish liquid at the bottom of a glass against this bright green, light color matcha mousse.
Tell us how you make the matcha mousse.
Yeah, you know, you take the tea, you dissolve it because it's the one tea that actually you're eating the tea leaves because they dissolve, they're powdered. So you take the tea leaf, which is already powdered, you buy it that way, of course, and you put a small amount of sugar and milk, and you bring that to a boil. So the tea is dissolving, and while it's still hot, you put a small amount of dissolved gelatin in it. And you then whip cream, and you fold cream into this cooled, you know, milk tea mixture, and that's the mousse.
And then it chills and sets?
It chills and sets lightly. Small amount of gelatin.
Do you put it in little mousse cups or
no,
in
I
a
just,
pan?
I put it, I, no, I let it cool enough that I can put it in a glass so that I'll see the layers. And, I, you know, sort of like, it's what we would call a vereen.
You want to see through it. You want to see all the layers.
Right.
Exactly. Sounds like a beautiful, beautiful dish.
It is fun. Yeah.
Okay, so good to see you again. Thanks so much for the recipe.
Thank you so much.
That was Robert Wemishner. He is instructor of professional baking at LA Trade Tech. He is here on his own at the market, just having so much fun discovering ingredients and loving the rhubarb. Talking now with Mario Trevino from Lompoc. He is the farmer who does bring the biggest amount of rhubarb into the market. He's at our Wednesday Santa Monica and Saturday Pico Farmers Markets. You're the only farmer who brings in rhubarb. Can you tell us how you grow it, why you decided to grow it, how much of it you have?
Well, there really no secret to it. The reason it grows, they grew up in Lompoc. Lompoc is a piece of land that goes into the ocean quite a few miles, and it's always cold over there.
So it's more of a cold weather crop.
It's the only crop I've seen that can take, we had 27 degrees 4 weeks ago. Everything froze except the rhubarb.
And the rhubarb was already up above ground, right? It wasn't like it was, you know, underground. It was up and it just survived
but
the frost.
What happens with rhubarb when it freezes, all the water goes down and the leaves wilt, like if it was dying. But when the freeze goes, it starts coming back up.
Okay, so it kind of somehow protects itself.
Well, yeah. I think what happens, the water goes back into the root and then comes back up.
But what made you decide to grow rhubarb?
The price.
The price?
The price.
Because nobody else has it?
Well, no, I've always seen it around $3 a pound, $4, $5 at the source.
Yeah, and so you thought, I can do that.
And the other thing is that the plant, I don't have to keep replanting it.
Yeah, they are perennial.
It's not like a cabbage that one crop and you have to plant over again. The first plants I have were maybe like 17 years old.
Really? You're harvesting 17-year-old plants?
Mm-hmm.
How many plants the very first time did you plant?
This plant, they actually came from Poland. My neighbor's from Poland. He brought this particular plant from over there. He gave me three plants to begin with. And I just let them grow. And after a few years, one plant, if you split it up, it can turn into seven or eight. And that's how I kept expanding.
So all your plants, your 2 acres, come from that original plant from Poland. That is an amazing story. That's amazing.
I just kept taking them out and spreading them out.
And they're still producing. So are you going to keep spreading them out?
As long as I can.
5 acres, maybe?
Well, I wish I could sell 5 acres, but you never know, Laura.
Right.
I realize there's one thing that it just keeps coming back.
Right. That was Mario Trevino. He grows in Lompoc, and as he described, Lompoc does protrude into the ocean, and it has seasonal mild temperatures year-round, so we get a lot of interesting produce out of Lompoc. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
After the break, we're talking to chef and author Dan Barber about a revolutionary approach to breeding seeds. It's fascinating, so don't go anywhere.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. If you spent any time at all in food sustainability circles, you know Dan Barber. He's the James Beard-winning chef and co-owner of Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, which is 30 miles outside of New York City. A few years ago, he wrote a hugely influential book called The Third Plate.
While we haven't talked about seeds, we haven't talked about them with the kind of enthusiasm that we speak of farm to table and the importance of local food and organic food.
Now Dan's going farther with a new project. He wants to overhaul the way seeds are bred. A new seed company is born. It's called Row 7.
What I started to discover in the research for the book was that, you know, once farmers have the seed, the cake's pretty much baked. And that if you are working with seeds that don't have the potential for the kind of flavor that chefs are looking for, then it really doesn't matter what kind of rotations or what kind of soil amendments or what kind of brilliant farming has come into play, it's a bit too late. And that revelation led me to learn more and more about seeds. And what I started to question was that heirlooms and old seeds, the kinds of things that chefs like me tend to privilege, because that's where the flavor is, so it makes sense. On the other hand, what I also started to realize was that it was really looking back, and that here I was writing a book, in the midst of writing a book, about the future of food, and yet I kept talking about harking back to old flavors and old seeds. And so there's this ironic moment in my maturation, becoming a better chef, I guess, and the realization that this nostalgia for the past wasn't a recipe for the future of good food, and that I needed to talk to plant breeders, modern plant breeders, who have largely been ignored. And that led me down a really wonderful rabbit hole of genetics and seed breeding and all the kinds of things that were available to us now if we engage with the right kind of breeders.
So the Badger Flame beet, you have worked with people to develop a beet that doesn't have the dirtiness of beets.
Yeah. I'll tell you, there's an origin story for the beets, and it really has to do with squash. And I don't mean to answer your question confusingly, but I think it gets to the heart of why I was asking for a different kind of beet. And the squash story is about meeting a squash breeder, really by accident, at my restaurant, Blue Hill. He came to eat. I went to the table, and I found him to be both engaging but also brilliant in the sense that he thought like a chef. So, of course, I thought he was brilliant. He was speaking and asking me questions about the meal in a way that made me think that this guy very much appreciated good flavor and was in pursuit of it, and I just thought it was someone I'd want to talk to more. So I invite him back in the kitchen after the meal, and we were looking at one of my cooks. This is 10 years ago. Okay, one of my cooks prep a soup for the next day with butternut squash. It was very late at night, and I was really joking with him, and I said, you know, if you're such a great squash breeder, why don't you breed a butternut squash that actually tastes good. I meant with all the heroics that us chefs and cooks, everyday home cooks do to make butternut squash taste good, whether adding honey or maple syrup or roasting and caramelizing whatever sugars are there or reducing the water content. We fight with butternut squash to make it taste sweet and delicious. And I said, why can't you just breed something that tastes good? And what he said to me really changed my life and in many ways was the beginning of this company and the beginning of my research with beets. And what he said was, you know, in all my years of breeding, no one has ever asked me to select for flavor. And I just thought that was such a stunningly simple way to articulate an enormous problem, which was that we have these current plant breeders all over the country that are public plant breeders. They work for land-grant universities. And they really are in service to the ideas and ideals of a changing food culture. That's why the system was put into place. They are publicly funded, which means they are funded from our tax dollars. And what I learned after that conversation was that most of the conversation that these breeders, these public plant breeders are having are not with people like you and me or with the groundswell of people who are advocating for a different kind of food system. They are, in fact, talking to the big food chain, and they are talking to agribusiness. They are talking to the people who want a one-size-fits-all approach to food. They want uniformity and yield. They want shelf life and all the kinds of things that chefs in particular are not that interested in, especially because flavor doesn't take the precedence. So that conversation led me really to the start of talking to a lot of plant breeders. And I was lucky enough, also in a moment of frustration, talked to a very brilliant beet breeder named Erwin Goldman at the University of Wisconsin. And he called me like in the mid-February, about 8 years ago. And we were talking on the phone in the kitchen. And I was in the midst of getting ticket after ticket into the kitchen from the dining room with waiters telling me that their customers, their diners at the table, were excited to eat a Blue Hill but did not want beets in their meal. Now, I don't know where the beet aversion comes from in this country, but it's large and it's a sector of the public that has a big voting power, at least in my restaurant. Anyway, out of frustration, I said to this beet breeder, in the same vein that I said to that squash breeder, Michael Mazurek, I said to the beet breeder, you know, can you breed a beet that actually people will like? And what he said to me is, you know, I too am frustrated by the lack of excitement around beets. And I have been working on a beet that is lower in its tannic, lower in its earthiness, because I identified a cluster of compounds called geosmin. And geosmin is what gives you that intense earthy flavor of beets. And if they are grown in conventional soils or poor soils, the geosmin usually explodes. And so you get something that's really, in my mind, not a tasty beet. And he said, you know, I have been selecting against the jasmine and I could do more of that. And I just thought that's the craziest thing. You could actually make a beet that is sweeter and more attractive for people who dislike beets. And so that's what we started working on together. He would send me from Wisconsin. I paid for gas and tolls for his graduate students. They came with dozens of varieties of these low geosmin beets. They were yellow beets, and we tested them in the kitchen and gave our feedback. And then the next year, he came back with more. Eventually, one was selected, and it's now called the Badger Flame. And it's a yellow beet that we serve in the restaurant raw.
It's completely gorgeous.
It's gorgeous. It is really gorgeous. It looks like a flame, and it is just stunning. It's a gateway drug into beets, is how I say it, because you really can eat a beautiful appetizer plate of it just simply raw, and you experience beet in a whole different way.
Are these seeds from row 7 meant for backyard gardeners? Are they meant for small or medium-sized farmers, market farmers, or are they meant for large-scale farms?
They're meant for everyone in between. We're selling a lot in the last week to home gardeners who are setting up their gardens for spring. We're focused on farmers because we're focused on chefs. So we've activated a network of 60 chefs in every region of the country. And essentially what we're saying to the chefs is these are chefs who have a relationship with a farmer or have a farm themselves. And we're saying we want you to test out these seeds, which we're sending to all the chefs. And then we want to get into a conversation with you that acknowledges your own region, your own ecology, your own cultural identity. Well, you know, what is it? What is your cuisine? What is your cooking? And how can the seeds of the future be responsive to that?
So who are the chefs in my region?
Well, I just got off the phone recently with Wolfgang Puck, which was an amazing conversation for me on a personal level because I've followed Wolfgang Puck for many, many years. And as a line cook, I used to go sit at the bar at Spago when I was off for the night cooking in L.A. And I would study the menu and order a glass of wine and get one of those pizzas. And I thought the ingredients were just so spectacular. And we forget that Wolfgang was one of the first chefs in the country to really celebrate American farmers and American ingredients and vegetables as a focus for the menu. And I was thrilled to have him excited about this and interested in creating new varieties for the future. So I'm really thrilled to be talking to him.
I've been talking with chef and food futurist Dan Barber about breeding seeds. He's the co-founder of the new seed company called Row7. Learn more at row7seeds.com. Now we turn to a little known yet incredibly delicious North American food tradition.
For a lot of people, not just Acadians, this resonance of doing things not because it's trendy, not because it's cool, it's because you can do this.
Simon Thibeault is a journalist from Halifax, Nova Scotia. His ancestors are Acadians. He's written about his culinary heritage in his book called Pantry and Palate, Remembering and Rediscovering Acadian Food.
So the Acadians are the descendants of the first French colonists to what is now Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and Prince Edward Island.
But there's a diaspora, let's say, because there was a war with England.
Yes. So the Acadians really became known because between 1755 and 1765, they were forcibly removed from that area because they wouldn't sign fealty to the English crown. They had been living in the area for over 150 years, and they didn't really see themselves as French citizens. And so they were removed. Some of them were allowed to come back. Some of them went to France and then later on went to Louisiana and became what are known today as Cajuns, so our cousins. It's interesting that it's very much diaspora, phonetically, like in terms of the way that accents and way people speak, all the way down to the traditions of how they cook.
So talk a little bit about authenticity in this context.
I think the term of authenticity is really difficult. I think you have a diasporic people, and so things are very authentic almost to your household. This is very simple peasant food. You're not really dealing with questions of really restaurants or a cuisine bourgeoise or even cuisine grand-mère like they have in France. This is very much stick-to-your-ribs kind of food, but very much sustained a people for generations.
A people who chose to stay in a part of the world that has a lot of challenges.
Oh, very much so. Like, you're dealing with farming on less than arable land, and so you're dealing with a lot of root vegetables and very hardworking conditions, or you're dealing with people who went fishing. And so if you look back even all the way back into the 20s and 30s, you're really not dealing with a lot of crazy ornamentations of food or whatnot. It's like, feed your family, keep them going, keep the generations going.
I wonder if you would introduce us to Rosalie and her notebooks.
So Rosalie Comeau was my maternal grandmother. She passed away when I was 4, so I never really got to know her. But when I started working on this book, I was really lost. It was my first cookbook. I was really lost as to where to go, where to focus. And Naomi Duguid, who has been a mentor of mine, she said, just write the recipes. And I mentioned this to my own mother, and she said, I have my mother's recipes. And she gave me this treasure trove of notebooks, which were her mother's, her aunt's, her great aunt's. It was this perfect encapsulation of rural life in Nova Scotia in the turn of the century, from like the 19-teens all the way into the 40s. But also interesting, Rosalie went to a finishing school. She went to the Collège des Ursulines, or the Ursuline College in Quebec City, or sorry, in Trois-Rivières in the province of Quebec, where she studied home economics, or les arts ménagers.
You talk in the book about how home economics is seen so differently now compared to what it was then, which was learning a set of skills that allowed you to run an economical household.
You had to. I mean, you talk to any community or individuals who are dealing with literally subsistence forms of farming and food production, You have rural communities. You have people who really think, okay, what's going to nourish my family? What's going to keep them full, give them energy? What's going to make things economically feasible?
So the thing that I think I'm going to make right away, which of course I don't need to make because our climate is so different than someone who is experiencing spring in such a northern clime. But the oignon salé, could you describe what they are and how they're used?
Salted onions or oignon salé is very much a thing of where I grew up in southwestern Nova Scotia. You basically use it as your base seasoning for most things that you make. Instead of just getting that little bit of salt, you're getting this beautiful, well-rounded flavor that lifts things up. But essentially, you just cut them up very finely and salt the dickens out of them.
Now, are they green onions?
Yes.
So what fascinates me about that is the role that that must play throughout the year in cooking and then making the leap to Cajun cooking, in which scallions is used so much.
It's interesting, the connections between Acadians and Cajuns. The best example I ever heard was, imagine twin brothers separated at the age of 8 and meet again when they're 80, which is kind of what happened culturally. And there's always this sense of kinship. As soon as you say you're from Nova Scotia to someone from Louisiana, they're like, mon cousin, my cousin, and it's this constant thing. But the flavoring, as much as the scallions end up, they're always like, y'all foods is kind of dull flavored, like. But I included to make sure there's a lovely gentleman in Lafayette, Louisiana, named Lucius Fontenot, who still does traditional boucheries, actually. And so he gave me a recipe for a fricot, which is an Acadian dumpling soup. And he added Cajun sausage or tasso ham, as you like. He's like, this is what makes it Cajun.
So let's talk about potatoes.
Yes, ma'am.
Because they're used a lot in a lot of different ways. If someone asks us if we want poutine râpé, that's not going to be poutine covered with gravy.
No, we're not talking about the poutine as it exists in Quebec, which is the fries, the gravy, and the cheese curds, which as a Canadian always blew my mind when it became such a huge thing in the U.S. I'm like, we've had this all our lives, but I'm digressing. Poutine râpé is when the Acadians came back to what is now the area where I grew up in the Canadian Maritimes. They came in contact with various populations, and that influenced their cuisine. And the case of that was actually German. When potatoes were brought over to Germany, use of them in all kinds of myriad ways, one specifically was rasping them. And I don't mean grating, I mean rasping to the finest texture. You would then take that pulp of the rasped potatoes, you would squeeze out all of the starch out of it, and then you would reconstitute that pulp with stock or water. And from that is your base for all kinds of things, from the poutine râpé, where you would then add mashed potatoes and create basically a large dumpling about the size of a baseball, and usually studded with salt pork in the middle. And then you would boil the dickens out of that for 45 minutes to an hour. But that whole rasping things is also used in making what is known as râpure or râpi pie. Now, it is not a pie, Miss Evan Kleinman. It is a different beast.
But it is gorgeous. And I mean, what can you say about a dish that has potatoes, but then is garnished with melted butter? So describe what it is.
So you take those potatoes that you've rasped, you reconstitute that pulp with hot chicken stock. You then add that meat to your potato mixture, put it in a large casserole pan, and you will then bake that in a 375-degree oven for about 2.5 to 3 hours. And what you get is essentially almost like a potato gel or potato congee studded with pieces of meat inside of it. And then you just slather tons of butter on it. And if you're feeling indulgent, then you can add like salted pork rind on top.
This book is so extraordinary. When was the last time a book on Acadian cooking and foodways was published?
In 1974, a woman named Marielle Cormier-Boudreau and a gentleman whose name escapes me, of course, right now as I'm on air, wrote this really wonderful book called La Cuisine Acadienne, The Acadian Cookery. And it was translated in 2001 in English, only like decades later. So there have been no books really examining it other than that one. And so when I wrote this book, I have to be honest, I really wondered, okay, who's going to care about Acadian food? Maybe a few people where I'm living in Canadian Maritimes, but the book caught a lot of attention in Canada. And I think it's because of that diaspora.
But I think it's because it's more than just a book of recipes. The fact that throughout the book are sprinkled these beautiful images of the notebooks. So you see the incredible cursive handwriting, which kids don't even learn how to do anymore. And then you see all the blobs and spatters from the paper being actually next to the person making the dishes. And then you have these amazing historical images. Like, one that I love is the woman who's reading a local paper while she's churning butter with this amazing, I would love that little tabletop churn.
That was the photo still taken just in the 1950s. Just goes to show the kind of handiwork that continued amongst women of a very specific generation. And that's what the book is. It's very much a love letter to the women, my own family, but also generations of Acadian women who have done the work to feed us to who we are today. And I fought to have those photos in there because I really want people to understand who this woman was. But in writing the book, I came to understand this woman who I never really knew. And I came to understand who she was and what the life was for so many Acadian women. And that's a way of experiencing your culture I think most people don't have access to, and I'm incredibly grateful for that.
That's journalist and author Simon Thibeault. Pantry and Palette, Remembering and Rediscovering Acadian Food is his first book. It's quite lovely. After the break, a chef who's making the Japanese bento box an art form. Stay with us.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Certain foods seem ready-made for Instagram. Take the Japanese bento box. With its colorful array of expertly crafted bites, it's perfect for an aerial shot. Plus, it's incredibly delicious. Chef Brandon Goh is creating these takeaway works of art at Hayato at Row DTLA.
There are so many kinds of bento in Japan, and, you know, ranging from the cheap stuff in the convenience store all the way to special occasion type of things that you would bring. You know, one of my customers said, you know, when he went to ask his wife's parents for her hand in marriage, like, you have to bring some food to the house. So there are certain instances where you need a beautiful gift or something for a special occasion. Everything in between, you know, is basically fair game if you're trying to choose a starting point. And for myself, you know, I was working in fine dining in Japan. And so you start thinking about what is the best thing that you could possibly make to give someone to take away. And not talking about doing business or making money, but as a chef, if you're challenged to make the best possible meal in a box, what is it? And that's really what I'm trying to do with the bento box right now.
I want to talk a bit about your background because you're a restaurant kid. You grew up with your parents owning a restaurant here in LA.
My dad owns a sushi bar in Seal Beach that is, you know, a pretty casual place, a family type of restaurant. So I started making sushi there when I was about 15. And I made sushi during my weekends, free time, summer vacation. And then through college, I went to UCLA. I was making sushi while I was there. And then after that, I went to Japan to live for 6 months. I was always curious about working other kinds of Japanese food, and I worked in izakaya, and that was when my curiosity about different kinds of cooked food started to really emerge. Izakaya is basically pub food. It's Japanese, you know, casual kind of drinking food, usually with a little bit cheaper ingredients. It's not like a lot of live seafood and stuff like that.
Was your dad super excited that you took this path, or was he kind of devastated that you weren't going to come home and take over the restaurant?
Both, I think. I still haven't figured it out. He thinks I'm insane, but, you know, when he sees the product, I think he realizes that it's not something that could have been done at his restaurant or even anywhere else in Los Angeles.
You know, it's so interesting to me because hearing the word kaiseki, to me, your bento are kind of like kaiseki in a box.
The idea is the same thing. I use all the cooking techniques that you would for kaiseki. There's, you know, there's five Japanese cooking techniques. The only thing that's not in there is sashimi, but grilling, steaming, simmering, frying. You use all these things to excite the palate and to give your mind kind of a double take when you eat each thing. The next thing you eat should be completely different. And so you accomplish that by using different seasoning. One thing will have vinegar. One thing will just be dashi. One thing will have light soy sauce. One is dark soy sauce. One is sugar. And it's very important to have all those things in the box complement each other. But as opposed to dinner, you can't control the order people eat things in, which makes it much more difficult because at dinner, you can control the seasoning and there's a progression from light to strong at the end. Whereas in the bento box, if one thing is a little bit stronger flavored, everything has to have the same level of seasoning. Otherwise, if you eat something lighter afterwards, it'll taste bland. And so compared to my dinner food, I would say the level of seasoning is significantly stronger in the bento box just because of the order people eat things in, and also because it has to still taste good once it cools off. And so your palate responds to sugar and fat more in cold foods than it does when it's hot. So you know, for example, the cod, if you substitute another fish that's leaner and you grill it and it cools down to room temperature or even colder, it won't have the same impact on your palate as the fat and the sugar in the cod does. It's really a perfect item for a bento box.
Do you vary the components from day to day? When you served us a box, there was a programmatic menu which showed us where everything was in the box and explained what everything was. Are you able to do that every day?
I have not changed anything yet. Part of the selection of stuff that's in there, I think I chose because people that aren't familiar with Japanese food are going to eat this. It's not like dinner where you have to be pretty serious about kaiseki to want to come into the restaurant. People are taking it to their friends, taking it to the office. And so I feel like things that are classic that should be in a bento that are traditional is what I started with. And I would like to change it. I'm already thinking about changing it, but now there are people telling me that was my favorite. You can't take that out, you know.
Making 20 bento boxes a day for noon pickup, and you spend the morning with production and assembly. Can you just pick a couple of the items and describe them in detail to us?
There's a mix. There's a lot of nimono or simmered food inside the box. And so I do those things if, you know, it's kind of like braising. I do those things at night because they taste better the next day. So for example, the sweet potato that's in there, they eat it and they think it's simple because it just tastes like sugar and a sweet potato, but there's three or four steps in there. First, you need to soak it in water to get the bitterness and bring out the clarity of the potato itself. Then you cook it in water just to soften it. And then you cook it in the seasoning, which is sugar and soy sauce. And I use water for that because I don't particularly want the taste of dashi in there. But all these things, you know, with nimono, it's like playing a chord on a guitar. You want each thing, the sake, soy sauce, sugar, vinegar, all these things have to be like a musical chord. They have to be in balance to get the effect on the palate. And that chord has to resonate with the ingredient itself. So for each ingredient, all these things have their own seasoning to complement the vegetable itself. I'm just really looking for a lot of different textures to make it interesting because you open it and it's supposed to be entertaining, but also eating each bite, I want people to think, oh, wow, oh, that was good. That's different. Oh, that was totally different, too. And so, you know, attention to detail with each thing is something that's really important to me.
That's Chef Brandon Goh. We've been talking about the most elaborate takeout box you'll ever see, the bento box at Hayato. Be sure to reserve yours in advance for takeout by visiting hayatorestaurant.com. That is it for this week's Good Food. If you missed any part of the show, you know what to do. Just listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also find a podcast of our show on Apple Podcasts. Please leave us a review if you liked what you heard. It helps us a lot. And really quickly, if you haven't yet entered KCRW's Pie Contest, it's not too late, but do it now. The deadline is April 29th. Register at kcrw.com/pie. So many thanks to the team that makes Good Food. Nick Liao, Rosalie Atkinson, Laryl Garcia, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.